WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Tee and Paula Broadwell made the rounds of almost every talk show you can name when her book about General David Petraeus was published. Petraeus commanded our forces in Iraq and Afghanistan and turned things around during periods in both conflicts in which disaster appeared imminent and victory impossible. Paula Broadwell met Petraeus while working on her PhD and began cultivating a professional relationship with him, which led to his granting her unprecedented access to him and to military operations in Afghanistan for her doctoral dissertation, which grew into what became her book, All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. Now, Paula Broadwell is back in the news for a very different reason. Over the weekend, it was revealed that she was at the center of an investigation into a security leak, which led to the resignation of David Petraeus as director of the CIA. Broadwell is alleged to have had an affair with Petraeus and is also alleged to have sent threatening emails to another woman using the CIA director's personal Gmail account. According to ABC's Good Morning America, Petraeus ended the affair 4 months ago, which means that it was ongoing when she joined us in March to talk about their professional relationship, the then-general's conduct of operations in Afghanistan, and his transition to the CIA. In light of this weekend's revelations, there have been a lot of visits to the archive of our original broadcast on our website. Because of that heightened interest, we are rebroadcasting our conversation.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
You have an MA from Harvard. You're working on your PhD from the University of London. You're a West Point grad. You're a counterterrorism expert, and you've worked for military intelligence. You've lived in multiple countries, and yet today you live in Dilworth. Why and should we be concerned?
That I'm in Dilworth, you should feel very safe, actually.
Not that we have a counterterrorism expert in Dilworth.
Oh, I came here with my husband, and we've planted our roots and are very happy to be here. But this book has been a wonderful opportunity for me to go out and see the world and yet have the best of both worlds with a wonderful family life in Charlotte.
Yeah, you're a major in the Army Reserves. As I said, you went to West Point, and now you've done this book, and you are getting your doctorate in war studies. Where does this interest come from in you? What is it about war and the military that really, I guess, turns you on?
Well, I think it went back to the first Gulf War, Mike. I remember as a high school student watching the shock and awe campaign that we had in the first Gulf War and thinking, I knew I wanted to go into international relations, possibly into politics. And I thought, as a woman in those fields, if I could understand how to use the military instrument of power, I would be much more capable and could set myself apart. So I decided to pursue West Point. And West Point opened up a lot of doors for me, a lot of opportunities for someone who came from a small town in North Dakota. Got to see the world and live and travel and study in over 60 countries around the globe. So I felt the military was a wonderful opportunity for me to learn and expand my horizons. And it was fun until the point where my husband and I wanted to have children, and we were continually deployed to different continents. And that's when I decided to leave active duty and go into the reserves.
What is it about the military that you like? You're obviously an incredibly intelligent person, but there's a physical side to the military, and there's an order side to the military. What is it about that you like?
Well, you're right, Mike. What I really, really loved about West Point was the sort of holistic development of an individual. You focus on intellectual development, physical fitness, and military bearing or leadership training. And I liked that. It was fulfilling for me. It was challenging for me. West Point was a very demanding environment, as you can imagine, with the caliber of students that went there, and it pushed me to excel. I liked competing with the guys because I was very physically active, and that was a stimulating environment in that regard. But I think the biggest thing is now the focus on being a soldier and scholar, that you have to be a thinking warrior, if you will, and that's still fulfilling. I'm still active in the reserves, by the way. I'm assigned to teach at West Point as a reserve professor. But I think, you know, for most people that join the military, it's either just a way of life, a way to sort of escape your roots. But a lot of people see it as a training opportunity to become something bigger and better. And that's what I think happened with Petraeus. He was initially attracted to it because he lived so close to West Point, and it was part of his sort of social fabric in Cornwall and Hudson there in New York. And there were a number of professors and individuals that taught at West Point that lived in his little village. So even though it was during the Vietnam era and the military was not looked very highly upon, in fact, it was the least respected institution in the government, ranked lower than sewage workers, sewage cleaners, he still was attracted to it, and he went there, and it opened doors for him. And so there are a lot of parallels I felt in my life that applied to his life as well.
You seem to have I don't know if special relationship is the right word, but he's taken a liking to you over the years. I mean, you talked about him as being a mentor and about how he likes to mentor certain people. How did the two of you come to that relationship?
Well, obviously, we shared West Point as a common ground. We also shared running as a common ground. If you read in the preface of the book, I sort of lay out how one of our first interviews was done during a run. I proposed running with him, and I said I'd bring a recorder, and it's something he likes to do with young people that he's mentoring or developing. It's sort of a rite of passage. If you can keep up with him, then you're in the inner circle. So I thought, as a cross-country runner and indoor and outdoor track runner at West Point, who had maintained sort of my fitness level, that if I could run with him and prove myself, then this whole dissertation research project would go pretty well.
How fast does he run?
Well, he can run around a six-minute mile now. And remember, when he could run a six-minute mile when he was going through cancer treatment for prostate cancer. But in general, I think he tends to run a little longer mileage at a seven-minute mile pace. In any case, back to your original question, we had this sort of common passion for running and fitness. And I had this intense interest in exploring his intellectual history, his development, and why he believed so strongly in population-centric counterinsurgency, and why he felt so firmly that it was the answer for turning the tide in Iraq, and that if we applied it correctly in Afghanistan, we could possibly change the direction of the war there. So I was intrigued by that, and he was happy to help a young soldier scholar, if you will. I wasn't that unique. There are a lot of young people that he helps. Now, he refers many of them to me to give them some of the primary resources I've gathered over the years, but I think, he was concerned a little bit about his legacy, mm-hmm. as a leader in that position probably naturally would be, and he was excited to have someone whom he could trust, who understood both his background and experience in the military and his network. So many of the people in his social network were in my social network as well. In fact, four of my West Point classmates were his aides from the time he was a colonel to a senior general officer. So it was easy for me to gather information about his life, and he felt like this person, with whom he has a lot in common, could identify with this and kind of capture important elements of his legacy.
So I'm going to get back to this running thing. He runs a 6 or a 7 minute mile. You run how fast? You must run faster. You're a lot younger than he is.
Well, I can run about that pace. Remember, I have two kids at home, so it's a little bit of a challenge balancing.
You can run faster. Come on, be honest.
I can run a sub 6 minute mile, but I typically run 6 to 8 miles a day at about a 6:30 pace.
So you don't want to beat him, do you? I mean, when you're out there interviewing him or currying favor, you don't want to beat him, do you?
I was told on our first run not to beat him, that he doesn't like to be beat. But so we're running. So, okay, back to this interview. We start at the Pentagon, and we're running down to Washington Monument, and more interviewing along the way, the first 3 or 4 miles. Pretty soon he starts to pick up the pace, and I keep thinking I just have to keep him talking so that he's out of breath before I am. But at some point we both stop talking, and it turns into a race, and we're around the six-minute mile pace. And he starts to elbow a little bit, and I thought, no way. So I picked up the pace and finished ahead of him. And I think, again, it helped me to gain a rite of passage.
These interviews were for the doctoral dissertation, and it became this book, All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. Given your position in the Army Reserves, you're still an officer, you still go back, you teach at West Point, could you have written an unflattering portrait? And was it difficult for you to gauge what other people were telling you about him that you couldn't necessarily verify firsthand? In other words, could you afford to be skeptical?
Oh, I definitely was skeptical. A doctoral student is trained and encouraged to be skeptical. And I had a wonderful advisor, I still do, Sir Lawrence Friedman. And he would challenge me in every chapter that I submitted to be as objective as I could. But remember, this isn't necessarily Let me rephrase that. What I wanted to present was his intellectual history, his development. How did this individual arrive at his beliefs about population-centric counterinsurgency, and how did he develop his leadership behaviors? So what I looked at was three sort of big variables: his social networks, including his mentors and what they taught him about counterinsurgency and what they taught him about leadership and transformational leadership and inspiring others. I also looked in his social networks at subordinates, even myself being a sort of participant observer, if you will, and I looked at how he reached down and out to gather information to improve his situational awareness and to learn about the ground situation. He's done this throughout his whole career. So first was social networks. Second was his education. What did he learn at West Point that was different from his classmates or that sort of shaped his beliefs about war and leadership and the infantry, which is the branch he chose? And then he went on to pursue a PhD at Princeton, and he had a very sort of transformative experience there. He called it an out of his intellectual comfort zone experience, because in part he had been brought up in this military system, much like many of us who went through West Point, and not taught groupthink, but you know, we do tend to think alike and we get the same training and education. So when he went to Princeton, he was challenged by a lot of peaceniks and individuals who had very different thoughts and frameworks and heuristics than he did. So it was very transformative for him. The third thing I looked at was just his experiences. And by that I mean his deployment to Haiti, for example, and his involvement in nation building there, and the work that he did in rule of law development and detention issues with prisoners. And I show how he brought those experiences forward to Iraq and then to Afghanistan. I also look at his time in Bosnia and the experience he had with the CIA and special mission units and Joint Special Operations Command, some of the very elite fighting units that we have. And he was being educated. So again, the title of the book is The Education of General David Petraeus. What did he learn at these different points from these different people? And how did he transfer that later to Iraq and Afghanistan? So I wasn't necessarily trying to air anybody's dirty laundry or make him look good or bad. I was just trying to show a fact of his development, the facts behind his development.
Paula Broadwell is our guest. She is the author of All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. In this book, you describe him as a maverick. All the things that you just talked about would say he's just a guy who's toeing the line and learning all he can to make sure that what he's doing is right, not a maverick. What makes him a maverick?
Well, the maverick is a term that's borrowed from the literature, to come back to put my PhD hat on. And in the literature of military innovation studies, there are several theories on how organizations change and adapt. And the most prevalent is a top-down change. So President John F. Kennedy wanted U.S. Special Forces to conduct counterinsurgency operations. He mandated that they begin to do that in Vietnam, for example. Mm-hmm. So typically changes come from the very top down. When a change comes from within an institution, from somebody who's not necessarily senior, like chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or a geographic combatant commander, then the individual is called a maverick. So at the point when Petraeus really began to change the way we were fighting in Iraq, for example, when he was division commander of the 101st Airborne Division, he transitioned from combat operations to stability operations and counterinsurgency. And he was pulling from his experience earlier in his life in Central America, where he traveled with one of his mentors and saw six different insurgencies going on in the 80s, from his time in Haiti when he was conducting nation building, from his time in Bosnia when he worked with international organizations on a multi-year roadmap on a way to transition from war to stabilization. It doesn't happen overnight, but you need to have a multi-year roadmap. So all of that combined kind of came full circle. And I think insightful for him too to sort of have somebody trace his own development and for him to think, you know, critically about what were the most influential forces in his life.
You talk about him galvanizing institutional change, and I would think in an organization the size of the United States Army or the military in general, that's nearly impossible. I mean, one person can't do that,
right?
But he's done it, you say?
Well, I wouldn't give him all the credit for the change, but what he did was he led the way in Iraq, and there were other officers, other senior officers who were conducting COIN in a transition from combat to stabilization.
And COIN is?
Counterinsurgency operations. But he became sort of the face of it, in part because he's very good at public relations, but he also wanted to help the organization learn. So he would share these lessons learned at the larger, whether it was a video teleconference in Iraq, this is when he's a division commander still, trying to share with other division commanders what was working and what wasn't. When he left that assignment, he was then assigned to stand up the Iraqi military force. And then after that, he went to Fort Leavenworth, which is the Army's schoolhouse. And at this point, he's becoming a senior officer, but I would still call him a maverick.
More Charlotte Talks in a moment. We're repeating our conversation from March of this year with Paula Broadwell due to events of this weekend in which Broadwell was alleged to have had an affair with David Petraeus and to have used his personal Gmail account to send threatening emails to another woman. There has been heightened interest in this show on WFAE's website, and that is why we are repeating our earlier conversation with Paula Broadwell on the program today. That conversation continues in a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Cosmos Cafe, celebrating their 15-year anniversary with a variety of three-course menus now through Saturday, located at 300 North College Street and 8420 Ray Road in Ballantyne. CosmosCafe.com. And the Beckner Museum of Modern Art, presenting architect Dion Neutra, son of influential architect Richard Neutra, discussing modern architecture and working with his late father. Thursday, details at Beckner.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, fallout from the resignation of CIA Director David Petraeus and challenges for the Obama administration as it builds a new team.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're listening to our conversation earlier this year with Charlottean Paula Broadwell, author of All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. The archive of this program on our website has received heightened interest due to allegations of an affair Broadwell may have had with the general-turned-CIA director. I want to stress that these are allegations, not yet facts. To that point, we recently spent an hour with Corporal David Bixler, who was awarded the Silver Star and Purple Heart for valor in Afghanistan. A double amputee, he met Broadwell through her work with wounded veterans and told ABC News he had, quote, serious questions about who is connecting these dots and how, saying Paula Broadwell is not the type. She isn't, end quote. Broadwell is a West Point grad, a major in the Army Reserves. And when she joined us last March, I asked her if writing this book was a good experience for her.
Oh, it's been a wonderful experience. Not only just the adventure of traveling in Afghanistan and seeing our troops act in such valorous ways, and I've been very inspired by that, but it's been an honor to work very closely with General Petraeus. We've actually discussed writing another book together, and he probably can't put his name on it because he's an acting official, but it'll be more of an explicit leadership book that's sort of like a Stephen Covey type, Lessons in Transformational Leadership. There's a huge demand and a huge interest in that type of leadership in many different sectors. And I guess I'm saying that because I've received a lot of requests for speaking engagements from the reinsurance industry to corporations like Google and Amazon that are interested in innovative sort of adaptation. So we'll probably put that out in a year and a half or so. Mm-hmm. And I'll eventually work with him on his ultimate biography. I'm working pretty closely with the whole Petraeus family right now to continue to document his work at the CIA to the extent I can.
When you were in Afghanistan, for instance, did he know you were writing a book, or did he just think it was, or did you just think it was a doctoral dissertation at that point as well?
No, when he was selected to go to Afghanistan, I decided to pitch the book to an agent and to a publisher. And I had obviously kept in touch with him and let him know. But he was in Afghanistan and learning trial by fire. Remember, his position as COM ISAF was his entry-level position in Afghanistan. Whereas in Iraq, by the time he was the senior commander there, he'd had almost 4 years under his belt. So he was much more involved in the nuance and understanding and had great networks. But when he got to Afghanistan, there was a large uphill climb for him. And so he, I think, was a little focused on the mission and I think overlooked the fact that I sent him an email and said I was coming and writing a book, but he was still, he thought he was supporting me as a PhD student. But what he saw was that I was out in the field sharing hardship with the troops on the front line, going on patrols with guys, you know, facing IEDs. We got shot at while I was out on patrol on the Pakistan border, for example. And he saw how seriously I was taking my mission and wanted to continue to support it to the extent he could. So there, he obviously realized that I was writing a book, but it took, I think, a few months for him to do that.
I have to stop this and say something about the noise that you may or may not be hearing on the air. We are sitting in our Spirit Square studio with Paula Broadwell, and they are tearing up the street outside. of the window here, and that was something that was unplanned, so I apologize for any distraction that it might be causing. I know he had a relationship with you prior to his going to Afghanistan, and I'm just curious, because he took over for General McChrystal, who lost his command, essentially, because he gave a very candid, he gave a lot of access to and gave a very candid interview to a Rolling Stone writer. And it didn't come out very well in terms of the portrait that was painted as a result of that. That did not play into General Petraeus' decision-making? Did he think about that before he let you come in?
I'm sure he thought about it, and he was, you know, he had been interviewed, or he had been requested to conduct an interview with Michael Hastings as well, the fall that he was there, and they wouldn't give Hastings access. So he was, and he was obviously well aware of how the whole scenario played out with McChrystal. But I think he looked at me differently. Again, I was sort of an insider. I also had to sign non-disclosure agreements, but as a reservist, I probably was a little more accountable than Michael Hastings was. And I think I just had the trust and rapport, as I mentioned earlier, because a number of people in his network were friends, longtime friends of mine. I'd known them for 15 years. I'd served with them in you know, different theaters. And again, I think he felt he had, you know, understood that we had a certain special relationship where I wasn't going to violate something that, you know, not violate something, but I would expose something where there was operational security issues. And he knew I wasn't out to paint a dirty portrait of a commander and expose anything that was there or not.
You have two kids and a husband, and yet to write this book, you felt that it was necessary to go to Afghanistan, not only six times, but to embed with the troops for what? Months at a time?
No, a couple of weeks at a time.
A couple of weeks at a time?
Right, yeah.
But this was not embedding in the troops at the Hilton.
Not quite, no. But remember, I, as a serving military officer, I'd been to the field before, and frankly, I guess I'm a tomboy at heart, and I sort of enjoyed the experience.
But there was there not gunfire during this experience?
Sure, there was. I have to say that most of the time I was there, it was more peaceful. And the beginning of the story, if you will, with some of the units that embedded there, was in the summer of 2010, and there was pretty heavy fighting. Remember, that's when the 30,000 surge forces that the president approved had just arrived. So when those surge forces come, you can expect violence to increase because there's increased contact with the enemy. So there was some pretty heavy fighting. My first trip there wasn't until September, when a lot of the areas in the south had been mostly cleared, if you will. So the heavy fighting had kind of quieted down, and what the troops were now facing was just the IED emplacement every 20 meters or every 60 meters. So we had EOD teams that went out in front of the teams, went out in front of the patrols that I was on. And frankly, the battalion commanders with whom I embedded were they were concerned about my safety, as they would be with any journalist. So they would make the call whether the risk was worth it.
Were they less concerned about your safety than they would be for a journalist? Because not only were you a journalist, but you're a major.
No. I made a very clear. I made it very clear wherever I traveled. I never wore a uniform, obviously, and I was, you know, I really tried to differentiate between I am here as Paula Broadwell, the writer, not the Army Reserve Major.
How did your family feel about that aspect of this assignment or this process?
You just tell them post facto, and everything is. my husband is obviously an amazing man. He has an independent wife, and he's very supportive. My children are 4 and 6, and I'm very proud that they know where Afghanistan is and the challenges there. But I think sometimes you just don't share the concerns you have for your own safety.
What did the process of embedding with these troops do for you, give you in terms of information or understanding that you couldn't have gotten simply talking to them or talking to the general or talking to his advisors and his closest officers?
Well, I think two things. You get sort of the sense of the imminent danger that exists while you're there. You can feel it. I mean, the hair on your neck stands up. And you also see both the camaraderie the troops share from going through that experience and the grievances they have. And, for example, the post-traumatic stress disorder of losing a friend in battle or seeing some of the horrific casualties that they have. On the other hand, you also see a lot of the positive effects, many of which don't make the news right now. As you know, the news about Afghanistan is all negative.
Yeah.
But I still remain in touch with many of the units that are there, and there's still many positive things going on. And to have been there and walked ground in the Arghandab River Valley, for example, which in the summer of 2010 had, you know, was laced with IEDs. Villages were abandoned because the Taliban were using them as bomb-making factories, if you will. But when I went there in September and then January and April, I was able to play catch with a pomegranate with these kids. And I couldn't really say that I couldn't say that with credibility or conviction if somebody just told me that. But since I'd walked the ground and done it myself, I think I can be a lot more credible voice.
You also have top secret clearance, I'm told, because of your position with the military. How difficult is that to go in knowing that you can have or have had access to certain information that cannot be put in a dissertation, that cannot be put in a book, and maybe it's important information that would help us as readers understand either the conflict or the people involved, but you can't write about it. How do you handle that?
Well, remember, much of my career, 15 years in the Army, was in the military intelligence field, and I'm dealing with that classified information, and you learn to sort of bifurcate what is confidential and classified and what you can speak about. And I had to sign, again, non-disclosure agreements. I knew well enough what was the sort of category of classified information that shouldn't get out, whether it was because of OPSEC and it would put our troops at risk or Afghans at risk, or because it would reveal sources and means and methods. So by that I mean, if I was talking about some of the chatter that we picked up on signals intelligence, the chatter being, you know, Taliban talking to each other on cell phones, that would give away the fact that we have, you know, the capability to listen to them on cell phones. I'm speaking generically, obviously, but some of the information that the community picked up there, I couldn't write about what that actual information was. For example, that they're concerned in this certain area in Panjway that this new force that's moved in is overcoming them. Because it would reveal, if they found that in the open press, they would know that we're connecting or we're able to track them. And you don't want them to know we're tracking them so that they'll keep talking, right?
Right.
So I didn't find it very difficult. I will say, though, that because I am a reserve officer, I did have to have the book approved by the public affairs office at West Point, and I had to have some information redacted. And the information I had in there was about the Joint Special Operations Command, the elite special forces, special operations units that are conducting night raids, for example. And I think some of what I revealed was showing a little too much of their capability.
So you can't talk about it, but I'm just curious, how much of a leg up do we have? Is it possible to really, we may not win the war, but is it possible really to defeat the United States Army if you are the Taliban, or unless you are an army of equal size and technological superiority? Can you really beat us?
Well, we have to define win, and we have to define beating the United States Army, I guess. Remember what our objectives are. Our objectives in Afghanistan are to keep it from becoming a safe haven for al-Qaeda and other insurgents that would try to attack us again. We seem to forget what happened in 9/11, that it was sort of the mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others who were there plotting against us, were operating freely. It was a failed state. So nobody wants to create a Switzerland or thinks that we possibly can in Afghanistan. But if we can create a functioning security apparatus that can defend itself, and that doesn't mean that there will necessarily be a completely pacified country, but so long as terrorists cannot operate there freely, then that's sufficient. So by defeating the U.S. Army, no, I don't think that will happen. We have this transition plan in place. That was the thing that the president sent Petraeus to Afghanistan to conduct, was to set up
a
transition
plan. That
was
my next question.
Okay.
When he took over for General McChrystal, what did President Obama tell him the mission was?
The mission was to set the condition for transition to begin so that Afghans could take the lead in preventing al-Qaeda and other insurgents from setting up there as a safe haven. So that was very difficult for him to do. Remember, he had only 8 months really to make progress before he'd have to start winding down and have to start thinking about taking out the surge forces. So he worked with the Afghan government to set up several initiatives and to sort of expedite others. One of the first things he focused on was the development of the Afghan National Security Forces. So that's the 350,000 Afghan soldiers, sailors, airmen. I guess we don't have any sailors in Afghanistan, but all of the security apparatus. Mm-hmm. And he garnered more support from Congress to build those forces up. He also helped to initiate this program called the Village Stability Operations Afghan Local Police Initiative. Now, that was already underway within the Green Beret Special Forces community, but what he did was make it a sort of official program with the Afghan government sanctioning it. And that's one thing that Karzai just said he wanted our soldiers to pull out of these villages.
Right.
And the importance of these little village Afghan local police operations is that they create a chain link fence between the larger population bases where the ANSF, the Afghan National Security Forces, are. So they are sort of a buffer in the hinterland, which is really critical if you want to prevent the Taliban and insurgents from setting up in those areas again.
There's so many questions about this. What is the attraction to the population of Afghanistan, of the Taliban? I mean, the Taliban were hated, we were told, because they were so repressive. And then we pushed them out, and yet there are some people who want them back. What is it about the Taliban and that relationship that they have with the Afghanistani people?
The bottom line, Mike, is that they have provided some level of governance, and the Afghan government has not. So they provide Sharia law.
What is Hamid Karzai doing then if he's not providing some sort of government or order?
Remember that Afghanistan has never had a centralized government, and it's always been a sort of decentralized run at the local village level, at the district level, maybe the provincial level. And so we're trying to almost impose a sort of framework that may never work. It never has there. And that's one thing that Petraeus changed as well, really to try to have a bottom-up sort of approach where the districts and provinces are connecting with the government instead of depending on Karzai and his ministers to reach down and out to the villages. So the Taliban competes with the government because they provide some form of rule of law, if you will. Again, as I was saying, it's Sharia law. If someone steals something, may cut off the hand, but justice is served. Whereas the Afghan government may take months and months if they ever get to trying someone and providing representation.
Yeah, the media tends to focus on the bad news, I guess, because that's what people want to hear. And so I'm sure we don't hear the good news or much of the good news. But the bad news is that Hamid Karzai seems to be our friend and our foe at the same time, that he's corrupt, that his brother is certainly corrupt, that the Taliban come and go at will, and villagers switch allegiances almost like you change your socks, maybe more frequently. We have these reports, of course, of the soldiers, the Afghan soldiers that we've been training, turning their weapons on us and firing and killing, firing on us and killing us, our own troops. And then we have the incident, most recent incident of an American soldier who allegedly killed all these civilians in the middle of the night. Is that just the horror of war in general? This would have happened, it has happened in every conflict that ever reared its ugly head? Or is this something particular to Afghanistan?
Well, I guess every war is different. You can't say that that they're all going to play out the same way, obviously. There are different challenges, different cultural nuances, different leadership personalities. Karzai is a very difficult leader for the U.S. to work with, obviously.
Well, we put him in, didn't we? Didn't we choose
him? We did put him in. And you know, one of the fundamentals of a good counterinsurgency campaign is to have a legitimate government partner. And I think many of us question whether Karzai is a legitimate partner. And yet, you see, I saw Ambassador Eikenberry and now Ambassador Crocker, and I saw General Petraeus and now General Allen trying so hard to work with him and to, you know, treat him like the leader of the country that he is, but also to maintain our interests. And I think what has happened is that our interests don't align so well anymore. But that doesn't mean there's no hope.
So our interest, once again, is making sure that this is not a safe haven for terrorists. What are his interests?
Well, he's a politician at the end of the day, and I think his interest is in kind of maintaining his security and staying in office. But he tries to represent the people as well, and you know, not to be so disparaging about him, but you can understand his sentiment with this most recent incident,
right,
and his anger. Now, calling America a satanic force, that's going a little far, but he has been known to sort of have this vitriol that he doesn't maintain so well.
Well, he's biting the hand that's feeding him, essentially. If we were to pull out today, what would happen to him?
He'd probably find himself on a flagpole somewhere. And I think he recognizes that, but he also recognizes we're not going to pull out because our interest is in trying to not only save face, obviously, but maintain some semblance of security in that region.
David,
now, what's interesting, let me bring this back to David Petraeus in the book.
Yeah.
Now, he, as the CIA director, is still very involved in security in Afghanistan. The CIA has the largest ever presence outside of its footprint in Vietnam many decades ago in Afghanistan right now. And that's not just paramilitary operators, but it's the whole, you know, analytics staff and all the support staff that goes into their operations there. And they will maintain a presence there. Petraeus is working very closely with General Allen, the commander in Afghanistan, to support what the U.S. troops are doing, and they'll continue to work together closely. So he has an inherent interest in maintaining the progress that happened under his watch.
We have more with Paula Broadwell, author of All In, The Education of General David Petraeus, when Charlotte Talks continues. In light of allegations of an affair between Paula Broadwell and David Petraeus, which led to his resignation as CIA director, we are re-airing our conversation of last March. That conversation continues in a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE listeners. And the Southern Christmas Show, the 45th annual show, features holiday crafts, gifts, music, and food. Now through Sunday at the Park Expo and Conference Center. Details at southernchristmasshow.com. And James McElroy and Deal, a law firm helping individuals and businesses avoid problems, overcome obstacles, and minimize consequences for over 50 years. JMDLaw.com. Coming up on the Diane Rehm Show at 10, fallout from the resignation of CIA Director David Petraeus.
Hey, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk. You know, lots of us feel sentimental about our old cars.
I call mine rusty.
Appropriately so, I might add. Well, if it's time to trade up, why not do something meaningful with your beloved old car and turn it into Morning Edition or All Things Considered?
That's what happens when you donate it to the station.
Support your favorite WFAE shows using the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program. Visit WFAE.org to learn how. And thanks for your support.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're listening today to a rebroadcast of a conversation we had last March with Charlotte T. and Paula Broadwell, who had written the book All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. The then-general had given her unprecedented access to write the book, and over the weekend, allegations of an alleged affair between Broadwell and Petraeus led to his resignation as director of the CIA.
General Petraeus had an excellent relationship with President Bush. What was his relationship with President Obama when the president took office?
Well, one thing we show in the book, Mike, is the trajectory of his relationship from the time Petraeus was the commander in Iraq, mm-hmm. and it was then Senator Obama, and they were betting heads, if you will, because Petraeus believed the surge could work, and Obama was vocally quite against it at that point. Over the course of a couple of years, they continued to have sort of tension, probably healthy tension in some regard. It's always painted in the press as this crisis of leadership and challenge between civil-military relations. But I think the debates that took place in 2009 and 2010 over the policy in Afghanistan showed that there was a healthy debate between the military.
Well, you call him the professor, the general, the professor. And President Obama has an intellectual bent. He is an educated man. He went to Harvard. It is not the conventional wisdom that President Bush is in that league. He may be, but I'm just saying that people said he was not the intellectual that the current president is, and that evidently General David Petraeus is. So how do you explain the really close relationship that the general had with President Bush?
Well, I think that the president, President Bush, realized that Petraeus could become the face of the war and could be a more positive face than he was at that point. He was obviously very disparaged by the public, who felt that he had committed us obviously to a war that was unwinnable. Remember, when he selected Petraeus, the casualties in Iraq were horrific. There were up to 100 casualties per month, U.S. casualties, and obviously his ratings were very low. So he selected Petraeus to become the commander. Became good friends. They had constant communication, and I think Petraeus earned a lot of trust with others in the government at that point. Now, with Obama, he had a very different approach to managing his generals in the war, and he had less frequent communication. They did not have the weekly video teleconferences. They weren't. He called him occasionally while Petraeus was in Afghanistan. He came to visit, I think, twice, but they had minimal interaction. And Petraeus was okay with that as long as he felt like he had top cover, and he had lines of communication, if you will, through the Pentagon, through Mullen and Gates to get to the president. So it was clear he was still communicating, just through different paths. I think one thing we've tried to show in the book is that regardless of who the leader was, Petraeus finds a way to support the standards of civil-military relations, to support whatever the civilians above him are given as his orders to execute. And on the other hand, he's one of those leaders, to bring back the maverick term, where he's willing to push the line almost to insubordination if he has the facts and evidence to support whatever he believes and is advocating as a mm-hmm. course of action. So I think both presidents recognize that and recognize that he was very confident in the courses of action that he was recommending, and they were willing to support him, but in very different ways.
Between between his assignment in Iraq and his assignment in Afghanistan, he went to Central Command, which you say is an assignment that he really enjoyed and which has served him well in both Afghanistan and as now head of the CIA. I would think after a period of time in Iraq, you're pretty much done. And if he enjoyed his assignment at Central Command, why did he accept the assignment in Afghanistan?
Well, he likes to consider himself what Teddy Roosevelt calls an in-the-arena man. He would rather be in the arena fighting and on the front lines, and he likes to be considered a turnaround guy as well. So when the president asked him to leave his command at Central Command and ostensibly take a demotion, there's nothing else that he would say than of course, yes, sir. And he you know, it was a challenge for him again. It was his entry-level position. He was comfortable at Central Command, but he knew the war was not going well. He'd been intimately involved from Central Command, by the way, supporting General McChrystal, garnering resources for him, helping with the strategy when the White House was going through the review. So he was eager to serve. He, at the end of the day, if I could put on my psychologist hat, he just likes to perform. And a lot of this came back to his desire to please his father when he was a young, you know, mm-hmm. high schooler or whatever. His father was a crusty old Dutch sea captain who had children later in life. He was in his late 40s when David Petraeus was born and had not been around children a lot, and it was just very demanding, very results-oriented, and took no excuses. So you can see how throughout David Petraeus's life, he's always trying to please some sort of right. father figure in his life, whether a president or one of his mentors that we sort of profile in the book. And so, I mean, that sort of relates to why he would be excited to serve in Afghanistan.
And yet, after all the success in Iraq, all the success in Afghanistan, doing what he was told, doing what he was asked to do, and turning things around. I mean, he really turned things around.
He turned things around in Iraq. I wouldn't say he turned things around in Afghanistan.
Well, no.
He set positive conditions there, and I was going to say this earlier. The surge forces that he went there and oversaw for President Obama were successful in security operations. Analysts predicted that this year insurgent attacks would be up by 18% to 30%. Instead, in some areas in the South and Southwest, they're down by 30%. And in 37 of the last 44 weeks in Afghanistan, attacks have been down overall since last year. That's the first time in 11-year history of this war that attacks have really started to come down. So it's, you know, that's sort of turning the tide, but it's not a tipping point like we saw in Iraq. And part of the success in Iraq was that the locals stood up, and we helped to train and equip them, and they started this Sons of Iraq program. But there were 100,000 of them to help with the security operations in Iraq.
The locals in Iraq loved this man. They really looked up to him. They admired him. They had a genuine relationship with David Petraeus. That didn't happen in Afghanistan. Is that simply because he didn't have enough time? Because the conditions are so different, the people are so different, the country is so different?
Well, he spent almost 4.5 years in Iraq, mm-hmm. and he entered at a much lower level. He was a brigadier general, and he was a division commander, so he was interacting a lot more with the people at that lower rank, if you will. When he came to Afghanistan, the war was not going so well, and many of our allies, our coalition members, 47 at the time, were racing for the exits. So he had to focus not only in developing Afghan networks, but he had to focus on keeping the coalition together, and not only from running to the exits, but now we need to garner more support and put more resources into this to get it right, finally. He wasn't challenged by that because he knew that he could fall back on the general principles of executing a industrial-scale counterinsurgency. He'd done it in Iraq. He knew he could try to do it here. He knew the principles of it. Now, developing those networks took a little time, but he worked very hard. He, you know, had sometimes 20-hour days and nonstop. I mean, this guy is so driven. Up at 5 on the life cycle, studying his intel, and 20 meetings throughout the day or so, and twice a week he would go out on battlefield circulations. And I was privileged to travel with him on many of those battlefield circulations, to go to remote outposts on the Pakistan border, for example, or into the Hindu Kush, and he'd meet with troopers, but he'd meet with Afghans as well. I was fortunate to travel with him to a lot of Afghan ministerial meetings as well, so I could see how his relationships were developing with them. But you're right, at the end of the day, he did not have the same time or interaction, the same number of touch points with Afghans as he did with Iraqis.
You know, the Middle East is our Vietnam for the 2000s, I guess. And here's a man who's had great success in Iraq and did certifiably positive things in Afghanistan, if not completely successfully, certainly put us on the right path. And yet he was passed over to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And when you have two conflicts going in a certain area of the country and you are the expert and you've had success, why would they pass over him for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs?
Well, you're right. As we profile in the book, he was not even considered for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff position.
Not even considered.
But he was okay with that. I mean, it was
how
hurtful.
How could he? Seriously, how could he?
Because he's got such a positive attitude, number one. But number two, he recognized that he might not be selected since he knew he wasn't necessarily an Obama guy at the time. Now, I'd say he's an Obama guy. He's very close with the president. In fact, if the president doesn't select Joe Biden for a VP, we might see Petraeus selected. But at the time, he was not an Obama guy, and he knew that. So he'd already been thinking about what potential positions he could be offered. And he suggested the CIA position to Secretary Gates. He thought he would be able to stay in uniform and that ostensibly maybe somewhere down the line he could then become chairman again. But he knew that he was probably too much of a type A personality for Washington. In fact, one of my colleagues on the National Security Council gave me a quote from Vice President Biden that said, Biden had said that Washington is only big enough for one superstar and David Petraeus is not it. And that's important. You have to put that in context because the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is someone who advises the president, but should be somewhat, not pliable, but, you know, amenable to the president's sort of philosophy.
Right.
So now that Petraeus is at the agency, I can tell you how close his relationship is with the president because he is representing the president abroad. Last week, he was in Libya. He was in Turkey meeting with Prime Minister Erdogan talking about Syria and Iran. He was in France talking about things I can't tell you about. I don't even know. But, a couple of weeks ago, he was in Asia meeting with heads of state. So the president
is that normal for the head of the CIA to do?
Well, I think typically that position is obviously the work that he is doing. I guess it's always been a male director, but is kind of kept under the kept quiet and kept out of the press. I think that the president has recognized, as you've mentioned earlier, Petraeus has prolific networks around the world. He has incredible knowledge in conflict zones, and he likes to be an in-the-arena guy. He's very charming and diplomatic, and when he goes and meets with these heads of state and ministers of defense and heads of other intelligence agencies, he's representing the president's interests. So the interesting thing, I was going to say this earlier, is that we show in the book how their relationship has come full swing, if you will, 180 degrees, and now they're very close.
Leon Panetta was his predecessor at CIA. He is now the Secretary of Defense. Why not make General Petraeus the Secretary of Defense and leave Leon Panetta where he was?
I actually think that is there's a congressional mandate that an individual has to be out of uniform for 5 years before they can serve as Secretary of Defense. So I think what we may see, Mike, is that Petraeus will stay at the CIA as long as he possibly can. He really loves it. He says it's the best job ever. And again, he enjoyed the Central Command position, but now he's really in the arena and influencing important diplomatic and intelligence, obviously, decisions, especially as we draw down our troop presence in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And as we decide not to commit to large-scale boots-on-the-ground operations and we focus more on covert operations and covert wars, he's in a great place right now. So the not getting the chairman of the Joint Chiefs position was a blessing in disguise for him.
One of the problems with both the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is determining what constitutes success in those conflicts. Does General Petraeus have a definition for success? Did he have one in Iraq? Does he have one for Afghanistan, even though he's not in charge over there anymore, that would tell us, for instance, when it's time to go?
Well, we are on our way out. I mean, it is time to go, but
is it, or are we on our way out because the politics of the situation says it's
no,
time?
No, we didn't. Nobody wanted to fight an endless war there. And so while the military leaders were challenged when Obama put these brackets of our withdrawal plan on the overall campaign, we have to keep in mind that the head of a sovereign state, Karzai, said he wanted us out by 2014, wanted combat forces out by 2014. So,
but if we still think at the end of 2013 that the Taliban pose a significant threat to the security of the United States and that our leaving would create a vacuum that will allow them to do what they did before, therefore negating all of the treasure and lives lost, Would we stay?
Well, we will stay in some sort of presence. And what the plan right now is to draw down the rest of the surge forces by October of this year, and then to draw down the rest of the troops by 2013. But while we're drawing down combat forces, we are plussing up our advisors, our security force assistance advisors, and they're embedding with Afghan units and providing overwatch. The Afghan National Security Forces are becoming more and more capable. Of course, we can't overlook the green on blue, the mm-hmm. Afghans shooting Americans and so forth, and our troops are at risk, but we won't leave completely, and we won't leave our intelligence presence there. And furthermore, we'll still have the capability of conducting drone operations and so forth. So, we don't hope to set up a functioning Switzerland, if you will, but we do hope to have a disruption campaign, even if insurgents come back. And by the way, there are still some Al-Qaeda operatives right. present in Afghanistan, but as long as we can disrupt them and keep them on the move, that's the goal. And that's what we're doing with our larger global war on terrorism campaign. We're conducting the same kind of activity in Yemen, in Somalia, in Uganda, and so forth, in Thailand. So I think that's the sort of approach we'll take.
I only have a couple of minutes left about approaches. You say that in the future, despite the promises of more insurgencies, it is unlikely that the U.S. will choose to engage in large-scale counterinsurgency interventions because such wars take too long. The politics are complicated. Americans may not see the linkage to homeland security, and victories aren't clear-cut enough. There were those who were saying all those things when President Bush committed us to the war on terror. Can you fight, and does David Petraeus believe that you can fight a war on terror with military operations, or should it be these pinpoint special forces and police actions?
Well, he believes both, and I think he really is adamant about maintaining our capability to do that in the military. But remember, at the end of the day, we want to pass that capability off to the host nation. And so really what our focus should be and is, and we're transitioning to it, is training and equipping the local forces, whether in Afghanistan, even in Pakistan, mm-hmm. in Yemen. We are conducting security force assistance mission there so that they can do the disruption campaign for us on our behalf, but on their behalf as well.
In our conversation last March, Paula Broadwell went on to say that David Petraeus' military legacy was still playing out, but that he would be remembered for influencing the next generation of soldiers and encouraging them to be soldiers and scholars, to be intellectual in their pursuits, and to think outside the box. Now, however, Petraeus may face prosecution for adultery. ABC News is reporting the timeline of the alleged relationship between Petraeus and Paula Broadwell would mean that he was carrying on the affair for the majority of his tenure at the CIA, where he began in September 2011. If he carried on the alleged affair while serving in the Army, however, Petraeus could face charges according to Article 134 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which reprimands conduct of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces. It was because of heightened interest in the archive of this program on our website, in light of these allegations, that we decided to repeat our earlier conversation today.